I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
My name is Patrick Hester. His name is John Anilio, and you're listening to episode number 164 of the Functional Nerds podcast. And John, I don't have anything funny to add.
Okay, but that's all right. I think you were pretty funny in the last couple episodes, so you can have a down episode funny wise. But that is Hugo Award winning Patrick Hester. Patrick won for Best Fanzine for his work with SF Signal last year, and he also does their podcast over there. And produces for Mer Lafferty's.
And you didn't watch the Hugos live streaming.
I didn't watch the live stream because I was sort of burned by the year before when they weren't really working. And
last year Ustream pulled it because as soon as we started playing the Doctor Who clips that we had full permission to show, they pulled it for a copyright violation. This year, it was actually the hotel couldn't handle. I guess if you've ever been to any of these hotels, their infrastructure as far as internet and technology and stuff is not great. And so even though there was a wired connection, it kept failing. So that's what, but it is up now. And I just wanted to throw it out there. When I went up on stage, I said something that I thought was very funny. I said, we do what we do at SF Signal because we love science fiction and fantasy. You know, I said, I love science fiction and fantasy. John loves science fiction and he tolerates fantasy. And that got a chuckle from everybody except John, because he's like, oh great, now people are gonna be saying, no, you hate fantasy.
Well, that's pretty funny. I wish I saw that better. I'll have to go look. Is it up on YouTube?
Right? It is, yes. If you go, okay, if you watch it, it's like a minute or an hour and 10 minutes in.
Okay, I will check that out. So you can check out Patrick's website, atfmb.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at atfmb. My name is John Anilio. I am a songwriter and a composer, and you can check out my music over at johnanilio.com. You can follow me on Twitter at John Anilio, and we are delighted today to be joined by Brenda Cooper. Brenda writes science fiction and fantasy novels and short stories. Her next novel is The Diamond Deep, which will be out in October from Pyre. It's book two of a two-book series that started with The Creative Fire, also from Pyre. She has seven novels out and numerous short stories. Brenda is also a technology professional and a futurist and publishes nonfiction on the environment and future. You could check out her website, brenda-cooper.com. And Brenda lives in the Pacific Northwest and has three people, three dogs, and more than three computers and only one TV in it. Brenda, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, no problem. Now, you know, before we get into anything else, one of the things that I thought about, because I have the Creative Fire sitting, because Pyre is always nice enough to send us their books, did John Boccaccio did that cover. Am I correct in saying that?
Not only did John Boccaccio do that cover, but he won the Chesley Award for cover for a softback book for the year.
That is great. I saw that, and I was like, well, that is a damn good cover, and John's a fantastic artist, and happy to see him, and I'm sure that's nice as you for you as an author when you have an award-winning artist who wins for your book.
It's very nice. Actually, John has been fabulous to work with. He's a brilliant artist, but he's also just a fabulous human being.
You know what's really cool about John? When he gets these awards, you know, you see him in person. He's this great guy. He's very warm. He's very personable. You know, I don't think he likes to be touched. I don't think he's like a hugger or a handshaker. But you know, he's a very nice, warm person. And when he wins these awards, he gets up and he struts.
You know
and
what?
He does it so cool and so suave.
I think that's you. I've gotten hugs from John. Maybe he just hugs girls.
Yeah. You ain't his type, Patrick.
I guess so. Yeah.
Well, John was an early guest on Functional Nerds. I think he's one of the first. I think we had Lou Anders. I think we had Blake Charlton. I feel like he was like maybe our third or fourth guest. You know, and he was doing well back then, and he's doing even better now. And did the George R. R. Martin calendar for Song of Ice and Fire, and he's just doing lots of great work. So John's a great guy, and I think it's very cool that he's doing the artwork.
He needs a soundtrack. He needs like a really cool 70s kind of soundtrack for when he's strutting, you know, and he's doing that suave walk. I don't know.
Well, you know, he's just like he's used to being there now. You know, he's no more jitters for him. He's used to it. It's old hat to him.
Well, Patrick, I did see both you and John on the Hugo stage this year.
I was in the audience. I didn't strut.
That's right.
I was walking behind DiNardo, and someone stopped DiNardo. And if you want to hear that story, go over to SF Signal and listen to our episode 200, because he tells the story. But he thought I was in front of him. I was actually behind him. Someone stopped him and said something that was hilarious. And I think you can actually see it on the Hugo feed on the Ustream. But it was so funny that I bent over behind him. I was laughing so hard. I almost stumbled.
Okay, so I haven't got a Hugo yet. Were you nervous?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, yes. Yes. Yeah. No, and I didn't. I should have done the thing where you grabbed the microphone and pulled it, because my audio is very, very low. Mm-hmm. I should have done what Sanderson did, which is pull it up to my mouth, but I didn't do that. So yeah, it was very nervous. And then again, the whole story is over at SF Signal in the 200 episode. But when I got behind, you know, they take you down behind, and I thought I must have looked horrible, because John DiNardo was like, "And they have water here. Do you need some water? We can get you some water. There's water right over there. There's a table right here. It's got the water on it, and we can get you the water if you want the water. They get the water. The lady can help you with the water. The water's right here. We can get it for you if you need the water." And I'm going, "Man, I must look like shit."
So, and were you nervous, or was John nervous?
Well, it turns out he was projecting his nervousness onto me.
Yes.
But yes, it was horribly nerve-wracking. The good thing is that the lights are so bright up there that it's so dark I can't actually see people. I could see like the first row of people, so it wasn't too bad. And in that first row was Sean and Maguire making faces at me.
Of course.
And during the whole photo session, her and Kat and different people were making these horrible, horrible jokes, like, "Why does a squirrel fall out of the tree? Because it's dead." You know, just stuff like that, and it was cracking everybody up. So that helped alleviate the nervousness. But yeah, obviously you're horribly nervous as you're going into that.
I'm sure.
Yeah. No. Well, I'm delighted just to sort of be a part of this community. And I was saying, after the awards went down, like, not only did Patrick and John win for SF Signal, but our good friend Merle Lafferty won the Campbell Award this year, and our good friend Galen Dara won
my God,
Best
yes.
Fan Artist, which Galen we've known for quite a while, and she did some artwork for an album cover of mine and has done lots of cool work, so really happy for her to see her kind of advancing through that. So it's just, you know, it's I count myself very lucky to count these people very talented, very nice people. That's what I think people kind of miss sometimes, is that I think a lot of this, it is a community, and it is people working together and doing projects together and doing interesting things together. And usually when people work together, it's because they kind of like each other. They enjoy each other's time and they respect each other. And, you know, that's how this all works. And so I'm very happy to see so many people that I know being recognized for that. So
and to bring it full circle back to Picasso, I mean, I did get hugs from Galen Dara and Merle Lafferty and Chris Garcia and Lou Anders and Sandra Wickham and Gail Carriger. And I mean, the list goes on and on and on. So Picasso just doesn't know what he's missing.
Apparently. Well, I think that is a good segue into our picks of the week.
Picks of the week.
And Brenda, why don't you go first and tell us what your pick of the week is?
Actually, I just recently finished listening to Neil Gaiman's latest book, The Ocean at the End of the Lane. And I always listen to Neil, by the way, because his voice is so lovely that rather than read the book, which is also fabulous, I like to hear how he narrates it and how he puts it together. And I just adored that book. So anyone who hasn't yet read it, it's been out a month or so, you know, go get it. And better yet, go get the audio version and listen to him read to you.
Very cool. You know, and I just read, it was funny because I was in the library, one of the libraries around here, with my son. And they had this like little book on, you know, in the new releases section. And it was that speech that he gave, that commencement speech that I forget where it was. It was the make good art speech that he gave. And it was this sort of, it looked like just like kind of like a small press, because it was all, because obviously it wasn't that long. It was just a speech. It was just like all these like really creative sort of, you know, lettering and printing and all these crazy colors and printed at different angles and everything. And so I took that out and I just read that the other day. That's a really, you know, the speech is great too, but it's cool to read it. And Neil just has so many interesting things to say about creativity. And if you've heard him speak, you know, when you read him, you sort of hear his voice in your mm-hmm. head anyway. So, you know, I'm a big Neil Gaiman fan. So that's very cool. I haven't read the new one yet, though, so I will have to check that out. Patrick, what is your pick this week?
My pick this week is the Crispy Chicken Tenders Platter at Hillstone in Cherry Creek.
All right.
This is not your mother's Southern Fried Chicken. It's actually very light tempura batter. And they don't fry it in the oil. It's so light, and if you like fried chicken and you want that crunch, but you don't want all the stuff that goes along with fried chicken, this is your thing.
Cool. Is that a chain restaurant or is that a
Hillstone is a restaurant group.
Okay.
And they own many restaurants throughout the country. Mm-hmm. The particular one that they own in Cherry Creek is just called Hillstone.
Cool. Very good. My pick this week is last time I picked an album by Butch Walker, who is one of my my favorite singer-songwriters. And one of the I got back into him, even though I'd sort of lost contact with his work for the past few years. He was on an episode of Live from Daryl's House, which is this show that Daryl Hall runs out of his house, where he invites people on and they do their songs. And he was on there, and that was great. And they talked about a book that Butch Walker had written, and I'm like, Butch Walker wrote a book? That's weird, because he's only like a 40-year-old guy, and he's a singer-songwriter. He's not a novelist. So I went and checked that out, and it was essentially a memoir, and I read this book. So the name of his book is, it's called Drinking with Strangers, and that's sort of his life in a nutshell, I guess, from the time he was young. But he's led a really interesting life. As I said, last time he started in this band, or I first became aware of him in this band called Marvelous Three, who had a hit called Freak of the Week back in like 1998, but he actually, that was his second record contract. He, when he was 18 years old, he went out to Hollywood during the hair metal, you know, when Warrant and Poison and all those bands were going on. And he was actually signed to a deal with a band called South Gang then. They never did anything. They put out a record that did nothing, and you know, then Nirvana and Pearl Jam came and swept all those bands away. And then he sort of went back home to Atlanta and started Marvelous Three. So it's basically his whole story. And I think it's an interesting read, even if you don't know who this guy is, just to sort of see him going from these like hair metal experiences to this sort of indie rock thing, to then his producing with folks like Pink and Avril Lavigne and all these. So he sort of gets in every area of the music world over the past 20 years, and it's really cool to see his insights. And he's a very like Southern gentleman. He's from Georgia, so it's interesting to hear his sort of culture shock going to Hollywood, being from this place of, you know, manners, and now all of a sudden no manners. So it's really an interesting read. So it's called Drinking with Strangers, and it's by Butch Walker.
Have you seen Hell on Wheels?
No. That's a TV show.
Yeah, so the guy on there who plays he's the main character. He was in the Confederate Army. While he was away, the Yankees came down and killed his family, and I mean, that was like the genesis for the beginning of the show, was him hunting down those guys. Anyway, they had him on The View. Mm-hmm. And I saw a clip. He called one of the ladies there ma'am.
Oh, okay.
And she lost her shit. And he had to explain that it was not any, it was a Southern thing. You know, he was not disrespecting her. He was respecting her, because he's like, I'm in your house. You know, this is where you work, and this is your, you know, your little area. And so to respect you, I called you ma'am. It wasn't anything disrespectful at all. And when you said Southern gentleman, that came to mind.
Yeah, no, but that's yeah. I know here in New Jersey, if you call someone ma'am, they will freak
now,
out.
Now if he'd said bless your heart, he was totally saying fuck you.
that's a Southern.
Yes. Bless your heart.
Oh, I did not know that. Well, that's good to know. The next time I'm in the South.
So Brenda's bored.
Yeah, let's get on to our main topic.
Did I look bored?
No, not at all.
No, we heard audible snoring. It's okay. No,
you did not.
No, Patrick is teasing.
So, but what is the main topic, John?
Well, it's about science fiction, but it's also about Brenda being a futurist. So, maybe to start with, Brenda, you can explain what a futurist is and what they do. So in the words of Office Space, what is it you say you do, Brenda? Like, what is it you do here?
Well, futurist has lots of different definitions, all right? And there's sort of the really casual futurist on one side, which hopefully almost everybody is when they think about the future. And then there is a class of super well-trained people who like work with, or they're like the futurist for Sony or the futurist for gas and oil. And those are people who are really deep in this and do this for their day job. And I'm kind of in the middle of that.
What are we going to do? Where are we going? What are we going to do? That kind of stuff.
Yeah, what's happening, what are the trends, et cetera, et cetera. And I talk to business audiences. I give keynote speeches from time to time, mostly right now because I've been really busy. I've been writing, so I've been working on a series of things, some of which have shown up in the Futurist magazine. I'm writing a series called Backing into Eden, which is essentially talking about now that we're in a world which is by definition changing because of climate change and other things, population changes in energy, et cetera, what are we going to do to take care of what's left of the world and or the natural spaces, and how do we do that, and what kind of technologies are we going to use? So mostly that's looking at things that you sort of see as definite trends that are happening and saying, all right, given these definite trends, what are you going to do? For example, we know that we're going to continue to get more and more population, probably through 2050 and maybe a little bit longer. So there's going to be about a quarter as many people yet again on the world. Well, how are we going to feed that many people is one of the things that you might look at. One of the issues I've been looking really closely at lately is GMO foods, because that's really complex. And it's difficult to figure out what the truth is because there are so many people with so many deep feelings on so many different sides of the issues. And so as a futurist, you try to figure out what is the truth irrespective of things you don't want to hear.
Before you ask a question, I have to tell you, my dream podcast at this point is Brenda and Alton Brown talking about food. And the future of food, because Alton is my man crush. He is so freaking smart. And I've been listening to his podcast, which if no one's listening to it, they need to listen to the Alton Brown cast. And he was just recently talking about like genetically enhanced foods and corns and this and that. And I don't know if you know this, Brenda. He was talking about there was some strain of genetically enhanced corn that got out. And it wasn't supposed to. They were working on it, but somehow it got into like the food supply. It's in the corn now. And once it's there, they can't take it away.
There were some cross-pollination in the Northwest up here. And that may be what you're talking about, because that was some of the Monsanto corn that I believe it was the Monsanto corn that got out into some places that don't want
right.
You know, basically, these farms are often right next to each other. So there might be a Monsanto or a farm that is growing the Monsanto BT corn and right next to a farm that is specifically trying to grow not genetically modified stuff. And so obviously there can be some cross-pollination, and that is probably not something we want at this point.
Right. And it's not just about getting the genetically enhanced corn. You know, a lot of futurists are looking at, you know, how could we grow corn more efficiently, for example. But from Alton's point of view, he's also wondering, we don't really know what that corn's going to do to us as humans yet. We don't know if it's going to have an effect on us.
Most tests so far say that the food is not necessarily going to be bad for us and probably isn't. But I just read an article this morning that was suggesting that the Roundup that they put on the genetically enhanced Monsanto corn. But if we're going to talk genetic food, I want to go to some other things that are more positive in a minute. But the genetically enhanced Monsanto corn, so far it tests safe to eat. But one of the things it does is it's called Roundup Ready, meaning people can spray their fields with Roundup and have it not affect the corn, but it does affect all of the nasty bugs and other things like that that you don't want in your cornfield. And Roundup is safer than a lot of the other pesticides that are being used on the non-GM corn. However, the article I saw this morning suggested that some of the chemical properties of Roundup and the way it binds with things is affecting the soil in a way that might not be very positive. So that was pretty interesting. And I found that in the New York Times this morning, because I'm real sensitive to this topic, because I'm trying to figure out how to feel about it, because a lot of my friends are saying, hey, you shouldn't be so afraid of this stuff or so worried about it. But instinctively, I'm a little nervous of it. So I'm wanting to really try to figure out what the real story is.
Wow. And John, I'm sorry that I completely hijacked you.
Oh, no, it's okay, because I think she answered my question, which was I've heard the phrase GML foods before, but I didn't know. Is it genetically modified? What does it stand for, GML foods, when you say it?
Well, GMO is genetically modified organism. Okay. There's actually GMO plants and animals. Mm-hmm. And the most common GMO food that we use are corn, soybeans, things like that. And many of those have been developed by Monsanto. Which is a large agribusiness, and not all of their business practices are things people approve of, and people are worried about whether or not there's enough testing. So far, most of the testing shows nothing really bad happens of it, but there hasn't been that much time.
Right.
Okay, and so things like the soil article just came up today, and it was the first time I'd seen that brought up as a potential side effect, because I guess it takes a few years of treating the soil with extra Roundup for it to begin to damage the soil. Mm-hmm. Okay, but even this wasn't a scientific study. So, you know, it's really hard. What I've been trying to do is find scientific studies instead of emotional arguments, because there's huge emotional arguments on both sides of the issue. Because it scares us. We're messing with our food supply, and I think by definition that's scary. But let me talk for just a second, but then I want to get off GMO food, so this isn't all about that.
Sure.
But another piece of that, there's something called golden rice that was manufactured not by a for-profit company, but has been created, if you will, in order to solve a vitamin A deficiency that's happening in European countries that causes a lot of blindness. The vitamin A deficiency causes the blindness. So they figured out a way to get more vitamin A into rice, and they're just beginning to introduce that. And that was created, and it's sort of open source in the sense that it's available for people. There's no, we're going to reserve seeds and you have to buy them from us stuff. It's not a business. And that was created just to address a health problem, which is a very different way of looking at genetically modified foods than the we're going to do a for-profit thing and try to be able to grow more corn cheaper. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of different sides to GMO foods if you really start looking at them. And there are still things that are scary and there are things that are hopeful. And it's sort of it's a complex new technology that needs to be regulated. And I'm all for labeling, for that matter. But I think we shouldn't just be scared of it just to the point of not actually taking a look at it and paying some attention to the things that we do that are good.
Now I'm kicking myself because we saw each other for a total of 30 seconds at Worldcon. And I wish that I had spent hours talking to you, because this stuff is so fascinating, and you speak about it so intelligently, and I want to sit there and listen.
Well, this is why I like the futurist work. It keeps me around really, really smart people. And there are a lot of David Brin is a futurist and writes futurist stuff and shows up at the same futurist conferences that I do. His book, The Transparent Society, was a futurist book. Yeah.
Okay. I have one more question for you. as a futurist, I mean, obviously it's you have to not only know what's going on right now, but where people are thinking about going, where they're actually going. One of the criticisms of Worldcon, and we were talking a little bit about Worldcon, is that it is a graying fandom. Mm-hmm. I feel, and this is totally me, I feel like since my first Worldcon, my impression has been that there's a large core portion of fandom who are these rabid science fiction fans. They love science fiction. It's the core of who they are, and they're scared to death of the future. Does that make sense?
I think that's true. I also think there are a lot of people that are scared to death of the future now. Mm. When I give talks, at least a few people come up after every talk and say, because I'm generally positive, and a lot of my friends are generally positive and believe we can create a better future, but there are people that come up and they're just are very frightened of the future because they see overpopulation, they see, you know, chemicals, they see trouble with the food supply, they see any one of a number of things. And we have huge issues, climate change, huge issues, that we don't really know how to solve and we're still working on solving. I believe we will be able to solve them. A lot of people I know believe that. But there's so much negative news that I run into a lot of people who were worried about any one of a number of problems.
Gotcha.
I think one of the other reasons why people are generally afraid of the future is the speed of innovation in, say, the past 20 years.
It's, the 18 month Moore's Law cycle.
Yes. I have a new coworker who's one of the other music teachers that's in my school 2 days a week, and she's only 23. And we were talking about different things, and we were talking about something with like the email, and I was like, oh, you know, I'm only 39, but I've been in this school for 17 years. This is my first job out of school. So I was telling her, I'm like, oh, when I started, like, we didn't even have computers in all the rooms, and like we didn't all have email. Our email was just sort of just coming around, and it was sort of suggested that maybe you use your email, and it was all this kind of silly stuff. And then I was like, oh yeah, when I was in college, which was only, you know, 1995 or 96 or something, I was like, I took a class, a computers class, where the professor explained to us what the internet was. That's not that long ago. And our world is totally different now. Everybody lives in the internet, like everybody does, whether the internet used to be like, oh, you're a techie person because you're into the internet. It's like, no, that's our world, and everything is moving so fast. I think if you sort of look ahead to the future, it's like, well, if things keep going as fast as they are, where are we in not 100 years, but where are we in 10 years? Like, how are things going to be different in 10 years even? So I think that's where people get kind of frightened.
If only there was someone who had their finger on the pulse of these kinds of things that we could ask.
I actually think you're right, because, you know, tomorrow's different than today. You know, right now I'm wearing a Dick Tracy watch because I've got my, you know, my Pebble Kickstarter edition watch on, and I'm, you know, doing a lot of fairly futuristic things that I couldn't have even imagined 10 or 15 years ago, or I would have thought would have taken a lot longer. And then there's other things we thought would happen sooner that haven't, like space travel, getting to the moon, asteroid mining, all sorts of other things, jetpacks. You name it. Jetpacks.
I'm a jetpack, Sam.
Yeah, DiNardo says I can't have a jetpack because if we had jetpacks, there'd be like a million deaths a year.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, I think you're right that's quite a bit of it. And that, in fact, makes it harder to be a futurist, and I think in some ways harder to be a science fiction writer now.
Well, and also, you know, I think a lot about education, not only because it's my job, but I think about my college experience, for instance, and how important it was to me as a developing human being. But I wonder about the future of higher education as well, because costs are so high now. And it used to be you had to go there because that was the only place you can get that sort of information and that kind of training. And really, you can get that information and that education alternatively now. So what is does higher education, traditional higher education, I should say, have the value that it once had? Also, it's so much more expensive than it even was. So where does that leave our future, just in terms of education? It's an unusual time, and I'm very interested to see how that shakes out. And you know, the other point is too, is because what are we educating our students, our higher education students? It used to be very sort of trade specific, like, okay, you wanted to be, you know, whatever, like a communications degree. That's a good one. I had a lot of friends who were communications majors. It's like they would teach you how to use certain machines and how to edit on reel to reel or something like that. It's like, well, now that technology moves so fast and it changes so much that you can't really teach that because it's going to be a new technology in 2 years anyway. So what do you teach people at that level? You know, you teach them ideas, you teach them thinking. It's all sorts of different things. So I just wonder how, because I think we're in an era of great change in terms of that.
I think we're in a huge period of change for education. I think there's probably three things worth talking about. A couple of them you already touched on. One is you have sort of a movement of education getting more and more expensive, which I think is frankly a failure of our it's a cultural failure on our part as a society, but I'll leave that alone lest I stray into places I shouldn't go on the podcast. But at the same time, there's this counter movement in all these massive online courses where you can actually get some of the best courses in the world for free online or for very cheaply online. And people all over the country or all over the world can take classes from, say, the best Harvard professor who's available or the best professor at the Sorbonne or whatever. And that's a, sort of a different kind of a movement. And I think the third, which addresses the speed of change we were talking about and your question from a minute ago, is kind of just-in-time learning. I run a technology shop. I actually have a day job in addition to being a futurist and a writer. And in my technology shop, of course, people have to learn things all the time. We were just talking about how fast computers change. And so we use a thing called lynda.com that lets people take sort of just-in-time classes, or we send them to classes right before they need the education. So people are regularly getting education, but instead of getting it in a big blob, which then prepares them for the rest of their lives, they're getting it as they need it because things change so much faster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've actually looked at some of those Lynda. It's like Lynda, I believe.
Uh-huh.
And they have some great courses up there. Just like, and I've just seen the ones like some of the free. I know you could sort of subscribe or do a pay model with them too, but you know, a lot of their stuff is even just up on YouTube. Like little things, like I wanted to learn how to do something within the music software that I have, and I didn't know how to do it. And instead of like looking through the manual, I'm like, well, why don't I just plug this into YouTube and see what comes up? And it was like this one Lynda video, which is great. It was a 2-minute video. It told me exactly what I needed to do. And it was very clear. And I learned it and I did it. And now I know how to do that. So it's that's how kind of our world works. There's always these new challenges that come up. And almost one of the things that is a skill to learn is to learn how to find information, to learn how to find these things, and to learn how to sort of teach yourself in a lot of ways. Like, you know, rather than just this, you know, I mean, there's certain fields where you're probably always going to need that higher education, like a medical doctor. Like, I don't know if we'd all want to have our heart surgeons, you know, just looking at online videos to learn how to do it. But, you know, with a lot of things, do you even need that traditional higher education? I don't know.
Well, the current generation of people who are teenagers and in their 20s, most of them, and there have been some studies, I can't cite any of them, I've read them, but I'm citing this on information that I've read, many or heard at a futures conference a few months ago. Many of them actually don't have an interest in a regular job at all. They plan to be entrepreneurs, probably serial entrepreneurs, maybe even own multiple companies. And that gives them no real interest in a 4-year degree or an 8-year degree.
I just read something about how employment might change going forward as well. And you might not have people going for the full-time job, that they might be, you know, specialists in a certain area who just do freelance work.
Mm-hmm.
And freelance for companies.
I think that's true.
And I think that's something that a lot of companies would almost prefer, because then they don't have to deal with, you know, health insurance and benefits, and, you know, they just pay for the work as it comes down. You know, so that can definitely be a way that our workforce is going
to be. But what that's going to do is on the freelancer, that's going to make it harder for them to make ends meet, because they're going to have to scramble to find the work.
That depends on the skill that they have. There are certain technology skills, for example, that tend to be very specialized, and people can get paid an awful lot of money for them, but it's cheaper for me to contract out to a specialist to do that than to keep someone up to speed on it. There are certain web programming and other things like that that happen that way. So I'm not sure they can't make more money. And there are, I believe there's some evolving markets for how to find those people, internet sites and things like that, but it's not something I've done that much of.
Well, and you talk about the evolving markets and the specialties. There has always been a little bit of that, because I knew a guy who his job was an AS400 administrator.
Right.
And I'm sure Brenda knows the AS400. That mm-hmm. thing was a beast. But there's not a lot of those around anymore. You know, so that's that was a job that had a shelf life. And as things are changing, I think these specialties are going to have shelf lives. You know, maybe right now social media manager is a big deal, but maybe in 5 years it's not. Maybe that's something else. You know, what's the next big thing that comes along? We don't know yet.
I think that's right.
we talked about it. Now, one of the, you know, we had another futurist on here. I believe Madeline Ashby is a futurist as well. We talked a little bit about some of the work that she does. And I feel like I read an article that I think you interviewed her for SF Signal, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct, Brenda?
I did. I like Madeline very much. She's very sharp. Her writing is sharp and interesting in science fiction side. I haven't seen her actually in her futurist role, but I've seen some of her posts and things, and she's actually, you know, quite thoughtful and sharp. And it's nice to see other female futurists because it's sort of like fandom. It's a place where there aren't as many people of color and there aren't as many women as it would be nice to have.
Yeah, because she was explaining to us a couple of the jobs that she's had, because I guess she kind of works in a sort of freelance capacity, too, where she'll be hired by a company to... Was she saying she worked at the Denver airport, Patrick? Were we talking about that with her?
Or
were we
just talking about that?
Yeah, I don't know. We were talking a little bit about some of the different things she did. So, you know, you talk about your work, Brenda. So we talked about the education. We've talked about some of the food things. What's another kind of big topic that you deal with,
or what do you want to talk about, Brenda?
Yeah.
Because we've kind of dominated this with questions.
I think if I were going to talk about futurism, what I would talk about is some of the work of a local writer here named Ramez Nam, who is both a science fiction writer and a futurist. Yep. In fact, he keynoted one of the lunches at the World Future Society that I just attended in Chicago earlier this year, where I gave a talk on the Backing into Eden series that I'm working on. And one of the things he talks about, and Peter Diamandis talks about in a book of his called Abundance, is innovation. You know, as all of these changes are happening so fast, the things we were just talking about, we're beginning to get the tools that we need to get a handle on the big problems we also referenced earlier. And the speed of change is in many ways helping us. For example, if you look at solar, the cost of solar has gone down by a phenomenal amount. And moving to solar energy would be fabulous in a number of ways. Not the least of which is that it's generally a non-polluting, free, regularly available. More energy falls onto the planet from the sun every day than, I'm trying to think of how Mez puts this because he uses it in his speech, but more comes down every day than I think we would need in a year for all of humanity's energy needs. So it's really interesting to see how fast the price of solar has gone down. It's almost been a Moore's Law piece because more money is being put into that. So we're going to be able to see fairly fast changes in some of the ways and places that we actually need fast change. And that's because we have so many people with so many neat ways to get ideas and because of the network effects of thought. If you think about the network effects of social media, or even imagine that 10 years ago I couldn't have done this podcast with you because we wouldn't have had the tools. And now the tools are part of things we carry around like iPads, and I could have done this on an iPhone. We're going to be able to have those kind of network. We're having those kind of networks effects in thought. I mean, there's a TED Talk that talks about how people bring up ideas and ideas feed on each other. And he actually calls it the sexuality of ideas or something very much like that, because there's so much synergy that happens when we have so many brains and so many people that can be working together on a problem from all over the world. And that's part of why I tend to be a positive futurist. I tend to be positive in my writing too. I mean, it doesn't mean there's no tension and that nothing scary or bad happens, but I think that, you know, we as human beings have the ability to create a better place both for ourselves and for our kids and for their kids. And a lot of people I know don't think that's true, but I really think it is. So I guess that's my kind of favorite message.
I love your brain.
Yeah, I think that is an excellent way to wrap it up. Brenda, you were just an absolute delight to have on, and lots of interesting stuff, and we definitely have to have you back on sooner rather than later. So thank you so much for coming on today. So once again, for Brenda, you know, her website is just brenda-cooper.com. Her two most recent books of The Diamond Deep will be out very soon. That is the second book in her Pyre series, and the first book is The Creative Fire, with the award-winning cover by John Picasso, who doesn't want to hug Patrick. So buy it just to spite Patrick. Just to put a penny in John Picasso's account and just spite Patrick. But they're beautiful covers, and I'm really looking forward to reading it. And anything else you want to tell our listeners before they go? The upcoming appearances, other books you're working on that you want to let people know about?
Probably the shortest or the one thing I'd leave with is I have a story out in a Prime Books anthology. I think it's Halloween, the Magic, the Mystery, and the Macabre. And this is a good time to pick up Halloween stories, and there'll be a whole series of really fun stories in that by a lot of us.
Cool, cool, very good. And that's from Prime Books, you said.
Yeah.
Cool, cool, very good. All right. So, what's your Twitter handle, Brenda?
Just at Brenda Cooper, no spaces.
All right.
Love to have people follow me.
Absolutely. And talk about, we'll chat up there, and this sort of ideas swimming around. Like you said, it's true. Yeah, things come up and people talk and bat around ideas, and it's not all cat videos. You know?
We didn't even get a chance to mention the Twitter hive mind.
Yes, exactly.
Thanks again, guys.
Yeah, no problem. Patrick, what do you have going on this week?
Same old, atfmb.com. You can go there. You can see there's a free chapter of my space opera on there for people to read. It is a little bit long. It's 11,000 words, but that's because I used that first chapter to introduce all the POV characters, and people are digging it, so go check that out. I'm still writing reviews of graphic novels for Kirkus. If you know of a science fiction or fantasy-themed non-superhero, no Batman, no Superman, no Green Lantern, graphic novel that you'd like me to go ahead and review on Kirkus, shoot me an email. If you go to atfmb.com, there's a little link on the sidebar. You can shoot me an email and tell me what that is. Other than that, still doing the guest doodles Wednesdays at atfmb.com. Still doing the SF Signal podcast. We're over 200 episodes now. And all the usual stuff.
Very good. You can just check out my songs and my instrumental pieces over at johnanelio.com. And you can follow me at John and Elio over on Twitter. Well, Brenda, again, thank you so much for coming on, and everyone else, we will see you next time. Bye. Endless conversation, a little more action, please. All this aggravation ain't satisfaction in me. A little more fight, a little less fun. A little less fight, a little more smart. Close your mouth and open up your heart, and maybe satisfy me. Satisfy me, baby.
Sold a face. of doubt and pain. Well, I won't back down. No, I won't back down. You can stand me up at the gates of hell, but I won't back down. Gonna stand my ground.
Here? It's over. Go home. Go.